Achieving a gorgeous grin from home isn't a total mystery with BiteClear aligners. Just don't be surprised if all of your sleuthing friends start asking, "What's your secret?" Begin by ordering your at-home impression kit today for only $14.95. BiteClear aligners are doctor-directed and delivered to your door. Treatment costs thousands less than braces. Plus, they offer flexible financing, accept eligible insurance, and you can pay with your HSA FSA. Get 80% off your impression kit when you use code WONDERY at Byte.com. That's BYTE.com. Start your confidence journey today with Byte.
Angie's List is now Angie, and we've heard a lot of theories about why.
I thought it was an eco move. Fewer words, less paper.
No, it was so you could say it faster.
No, it's to be more iconic.
Must be a tech thing.
But those aren't quite right. It's because now you can compare upfront prices, book a service instantly, and even get your project handled from start to finish.
Sounds easy.
It is, and it makes us so much more than just a list. Get started at Angie.com. That's A-N-G-I. Or download the app today.
Don't touch that dial. You're tuned in to the Dread Podcast Network.
Welcome to Development Hell. For every horror movie that hits VOD, countless others end up DOA. Development Hell is the podcast dedicated to unearthing these cursed horror productions. We're going to find out what went wrong and then decide if these titles still stand a shot at the green light. I am your host, Josh Korngut. I am a filmmaker in Toronto, Canada. This podcast is a proud member of the Dread Podcast Network.
Available now from Dread. Val. Finn, a wanted criminal, hides out with an escort named Val, a demon. Val offers to make his problems disappear if he follows her rules. She has been expecting him all along, and it won't be easy to escape Val's dungeon. Val is out now everywhere you buy or rent movies, and on Blu-ray November 2nd.
Welcome, everybody, to the fifth installment of our Halloween is Cancelled limited audio series. So this is our mini-series where we're tackling five or so cancelled Halloween sequels to get into the spirit. And today we are on number five. We're tackling Halloween Bad Blood. That's Josh Stolberg's Halloween Bad Blood. We have a very special returning guest star today. Welcome back, Jinx. How's it going?
Hey, thank you so much for having me back. I really appreciate it. Now, I just wanted to ask right up top, is this going to be the last installment of Halloween is Canceled for the season?
This is breaking news. I don't know. Maybe not. I want to keep it going till at least Halloween. I have a bonus episode banked. I'm just going to say it. It's a cute little Halloween kills review with my friend Jules.
Nice.
But we may get another episode squeezed in. We'll see. Who knows how the cookie crumbles? Not me. But this may be the season finale, though. So everyone needs to prepare themselves just in case.
Well, I just wanted to brace myself. I didn't know if I was going to be the guest that was seeing out this series. I'm already a little nervous that I'm following up Dunstan and Melton, which was a great episode, by the way. But I mean, how do I follow that act? I could lead in to Dunstan and Melton just fine, like that's okay, but now I'm following them up too, like that's a little bit of pressure, Josh.
It's a totally different kettle of fish, you know, like it was a circus and a fun one, but you and I were like, you know, we're the seminar, we're the University of Development Hall. It's a totally different thing.
I don't know that I should ever be put in charge of teaching anyone anything, but I'm more the guy that hangs out at the university and just likes to chat movies with people once they're done
no
with class.
No way, Jinx. You're a prof energy. You may not know it, but I believe it fully. And I feel like I am too. I'm like the college prof and you're like the university prof. And one is not worse than the other. You know what I mean? Like two different worlds.
You know, I've got a beard. I think I have a corduroy coat somewhere.
I'm sure you do.
I can look the part.
I love it. The Department of Development Hell. As I mentioned, today we are on Halloween Bad Blood. So Bad Blood is a Jamie Lloyd sequel that never got made, based on a treatment, if I'm not mistaken, by Josh Stolberg. I was wondering, you brought this one to the table. Why does this installment interest you? Why did you pick this topic?
Yeah, so I just want to shout out too. It is written by Josh Stolberg and Bobby Florsheim. So I just wanted to shout Mr. Florsheim out because he did have a hand in co-writing it. I was lucky enough to interview Mr. Stolberg, but I didn't get the chance to interview Mr. Florsheim. But when you'd reached out to me to come back on, you had mentioned a couple of potentials and. It's funny, I would have been fine with any of them, but one of them that you had picked, I believe, was Halloween Asylum, which Mr. Stolberg had actually, he had tackled one of the drafts on that. So I was like, yeah, we could talk about that, but I did interview the man and I know this much more. And there's a lot of like, you know,
you have the inside scoop. Let's just be honest.
I was able to read the treatments for both, and of course I interviewed Mr. Stolberg, who's a great guy, and not only that, but I mean, I just, you know, I gotta be honest with you, we touched on this on our previous chat, but I love Jamie Lloyd, and the idea of getting a Jamie Lloyd sequel, you know, it pisses me off that we didn't say have Twitter, really any sort of social media background, the late 90s. Otherwise, I would have been the first guy trying to push a hashtag justice for Jamie. You know, like it's
not too late. You have a sneaking feeling she might show up in Halloween Ends?
No, yeah, I do not. Not
as I said it out loud, it felt wrong. I wish, though. I would love to see Jamie, and I think the appetite and nostalgia is there in a way that it wouldn't have been, I think, pre Halloween 2018. Now we like want to see all these people come back. We are starting to celebrate the canon in the way that that reboot wasn't doing.
Yeah, I mean, I would love that. We have all these. It's been joked about before that Halloween is sort of becoming a choose your own adventure kind of set of continuities, you know. And it's I would like to think that we could dive back into older continuities perhaps in the future, but honestly, I don't think that's in the cards. I think Malachi Cod is all about looking toward the future and not necessarily going back. So I can't imagine we're going to be able to dive back into the Thorn storyline ever again, but is a shame because it you know, I'm a sucker for all of that stuff.
Who knows what HBO Max is going to produce in 10 years from now? We don't know. We don't know what they're capable of.
That would actually honestly be the best route for something like Halloween that regard. Like, you know what? If you want to keep Halloween a big theatrical franchise, go ahead and do that. But you know what? It used to drive me nuts that DC was not following the Marvel playbook, at least as far as their shared cinematic universe, you know, that sort of, that structure that Marvel so perfectly nailed. DC is just kind of more, whatever, you know, but now I've kind of come to appreciate it that they're not so beholden to continuity as, hey, what would fans really like to see? Or, hey, what would this amazing filmmaker do with a character like this? Okay, no Joker won't fit into the DCEU, but, you know, it might win Joaquin Phoenix an Oscar. It might earn us $1 billion. So why the hell don't we do it? You know, I wish that Malachi Cod could do something similar like that with Halloween. I wish he would keep, you know, the theatrical films going, but, you know, maybe give me an HBO Max Thorn miniseries. Halloween 3D on TV, maybe.
Listen, even if it doesn't happen, the Jinx curated graphic novels will, you know, so we're gonna get these at some point or another. We talked about this previously, you just kind of mentioned it, but I was wondering how do we feel about both Danielle Harris and Jamie Lloyd? We talked about it in the past, but I want to talk about it again. What was your like first introduction with Jamie Lloyd, the character? So Daniel Harris,
The first Halloween movie that I ever saw was Halloween 5, and it was on television. I was a kid. I was maybe like 9 or 10 at the time, and my brother, who was about 6 years older than me, he was responsible for terrorizing me with horror movies back when I was a kid. He would he knew I hated horror movies as a kid. I was terrified of being terrified, as it were. And so, and he delighted in scaring me with all manner of movies. You know, he would call me into the room during Friday the 13th and tell me to watch it with him. But I could hold a pillow and cover my eyes with it during the scary parts. And inevitably, when a scary part would come up, I would hold the pillow up. He would yank the pillow away. So I would see Jason Voorhees hacking up some poor unsuspecting teenager.
This is an education.
Absolutely. Well, you know what? I wound up becoming a huge horror fan, so he did something right.
Yeah.
But no, he was, I remember he and a friend had come over and they were watching Halloween 5, and there was something about seeing a child as a protagonist, being 9 or 10 myself at the time. And even though it was a scary movie, and even though Michael Myers fucking terrified me the first time I ever saw him, having a child as the lead of the movie, I couldn't look away. Like I sort of sat down and, you know, I didn't need the pillow. I didn't need to be pranked or cajoled into continuing to watch the movie. I was wrapped. And, you know, part of this is the fact that, you know, as a kid, I probably had a huge crush on Danielle Harris.
Classic.
And as a 40-year-old man, I have a huge crush on Danielle Harris.
Are you guys around the same age?
I would imagine.
Probably, yeah.
Sure. Yeah, she was... What was she? She was like 9 or 10, I think, when she did Halloween 5. So that tracks, I think.
Late 80s.
Yeah, but you know, not only that, but, and I think this holds true to this day, when you look at Halloween 5, and I eventually backtracked and watched, it's so weird, I watched the Halloween franchise completely out of order. I watched 5, I backtracked and watched 4, and then eventually I got around to watching 1, 2, and then when I got to 3, I was like, what the hell? liked it, just wanted to know where Michael was.
You're not alone.
And it got to the point where I was such a fan. And once I really got into horror movies proper, I mean, I was the guy who would pester my local, you know, video update or movie gallery or movie house to just get in all of the movies so I could rent them all and do movie marathons. And I would keep it running, man. I would prolong Halloween. Not only would I marathon Halloween's 1 through 5 at Halloween, no, I would also rent all 5 of them a month later and watch them during a long Thanksgiving weekend when I was off from school, just because
perfect
I adored
timing.
Them. But no, the thing that holds true, I think, for Halloween 5 and Halloween 4 is the fact that I think Danielle Harris, regardless of genre, forgetting the fact that they're horror movies, I think as a child actor, she gives one of the best performances in those movies that any child actor ever did, period.
Oh, yeah. Even adult actors in this series, she's up against the best.
She outshines them. She holds her own with Donald friggin' Pleasance. I mean, how amazing is that?
Oh yeah.
And so, I mean, I adore the character. I think it was such a smart idea to sort of ground the franchise at that point with a child. And then... my goodness, the filmmakers who cast her, like, what a boon for that franchise that they got her, because I think the work that she did was just utterly fucking fantastic.
Yeah, Halloween 4 was a real swing and not a miss, but a hit. Is a swing and a hit a saying? Because that's what it was.
Yeah, swing and a connect, swing and a home run, I think.
A home run. So I have a question for you, which is, okay, so who is Josh Stolberg? And who is this other writer? Can you say his name one more time so I remember?
It was Bobby Florsheim, I believe, and I hope I am pronouncing it correctly.
I remember how it looks on paper, and it was a question mark to pronounce, so thank you for doing that for me. I know that Josh Stolberg had his hand in writing the Piranha 3D remake, Sorority Row remake, Spiral, Jigsaw, all of these modern horror movies. I was just wondering, how did he, like, get involved with the Halloween franchise to start with?
So I believe it started out as a pitch. He had been writing on Sabrina, I believe, back in the 90s.
The animated series, right? Or was it also the live action one?
I think it was the animated series.
It's so cool.
I don't believe it was live action, which is great. But honestly, I didn't watch either. I'll admit it. Like, those had just missed me. When I was a teenager, that if anything even remotely smacked of horror, I was going to check it out. But that, you know, Sabrina, the Teenage Witch, like, it just...
Weirdly enough,
I would probably, because of, you know, the Chilling Adventures of Sabrina, the comic book, sadly, I haven't checked out the Netflix series yet, but because I love the comic book so much, I got to admit, I was very close to going ahead and checking out that old 90s show. I never got around to it, but I...
It's pretty classic, although, yeah, I think if you're not nostalgic for it, maybe it won't hit in the same way.
I hear you. No, I get it. But yeah, Josh Stolberg and Bobby Florsheim, they were called in to pitch to Mustafa Akkad And they pitched something during our interview. Josh Stolberg called it MVP, Michael versus Pinhead. The treatment that I read,
good title,
was alternatively called Halloween in Hell.
And, also a good title.
Sorry. Yeah, I mean, I've heard the alternate title for very, you know, there have been various like Halloween and Hellraiser pitches, I guess, back in the day, like three or four, and one of them was called Halloween, and it's just like
not as good.
You know, it depends on what day it is. Like there are times I hear that title and I'm like, nope. And then there are other times when I'm like, you know what, I'd watch the hell out of a movie called Halloween.
I know, I don't know how, because we're about to talk about Halloween in Hell a little bit right now. I don't know how I've never done an episode on Michael versus Pinhead yet. It just seems like a obvious choice and it just hasn't happened.
Well, it's a little tough to get a beat on, probably, because not only did you have the Stolberg and Bobby Florsheim pitch, you also had
Dave something.
I'm completely, please edit this out because he's the nicest guy and he's a hell of a filmmaker. Dave Parker.
Thank you. I got the first name right. Good for me.
Yeah, he was on my podcast. God, I suck. Dave Parker was
cool.
It's super nice guy. Like super horror savvy. Great guy to chat with. Made a couple of great horror films. He did The Dead Hate the Living. And if you ever get the chance, he did a Warner premiere movie called The Hills Run Red, written by David Scout. That is fucking great.
I've seen The Hills Run Red. Amazing.
Love it, love it. It should have been a franchise. We should have had three or four by now. So, but yeah, Dave Parker.
I get it mixed up with the houses that October built, but I know I've seen both, and that's what matters.
I like that one too. But yeah, I think he did Halloween, and then of course there was the time that they approached Clive Barker, and the idea was to get Barker to write and John Carpenter to direct, and oh, what a loss that was. Because even though, here's the thing, I'm not convinced that Halloween and Hellraiser goes together. That is not chocolate and peanut butter to me necessarily. I love both, but I don't know that they belong together. But you put Barker and Carpenter on the job, I think they would have given us something pretty great. But it didn't happen. So
two, or maybe it was actually your Phantom Limbs article about this item, but I think I read that Halloween in Hell sort of involved a survivor's group of final girls, including Kirstie from Hellraiser and Danielle Harris's character Jamie Lloyd from Halloween, as a sort of support group for final girls.
Yes.
Which is interesting because that will play a role in the title that we're talking about more specifically today, Halloween Bad Blood.
Yes. Yeah. So that was it's funny because Stolberg and Florsheim, they went in to pitch Halloween in Hell, and apparently it didn't go anywhere. And so they they kind of took the core idea that they had, with Jamie Lloyd being the protagonist, and they sort of just divorced it from Hellraiser, and then they created Halloween Bad Blood, which we can dive into. But yeah, I really love the idea of a support group filled with survivors of other horror movie franchises, because if I can talk about myself for a moment here, and it is worth noting that this treatment would have been written around, I think he said November of 2000. I don't know if that was Halloween Hellraiser or if that was Bad Blood, but in any case, this was like 2000 or so. But I was completely unaware, obviously, of this treatment, or I was unaware of anything that just hadn't been made. You know, Halloween at that point was just Halloween H2O to me. In 2004, Fangoria did this. It was kind of a contest called the Blood Drive. They had already put out one DVD compilation. What it was open to all horror filmmakers to make a short horror film and to send it into the Blood Drive. This would have been for the Blood Drive 2. And basically they would get judged. And then if you had a winning entry, it would go onto a DVD compilation that was branded like Fangoria. And they did two of them, right? Mm-hmm. I entered in a short film that I shot for the Blood Drive 2, and it was called Support, and it revolved around a support group for victims of movie franchise serial killers.
Wow.
So we started with a young woman who was attacked by essentially a giallo killer in a black leather coat, black gloves, black hat, who nearly kills her. She lives. she winds up going to a support group for people similarly like her. And each of them is like, you know, we had basically riffs on Marion from Psycho, Sally from Texas Chainsaw. we had a guy with four long claw marks down his face who was a, you know, an unapologetic, just coffee drinker, as it were, just constantly down and stuff. And yeah, it was kind of fun. It was kind of silly. The twist at the end of it was that the support group has basically taken upon themselves to, with each new member that they induct, they track down the person who hurt them and, they kill them and basically vanish them off the face of the planet. And, so that was my short, and I sent it off, and we were running up against the wire, and we didn't add a score, and it didn't get chosen. But I still love the idea, and I wound up rewriting it as a much more grounded thing a handful of years ago, and I was actually going to shoot it as a feature, and it never happened. But it's been an idea that I've been sitting on for the longest time, and still, I saw it was kind of a 1-2 punch when I did the interview with Josh Stahlberg and he mentioned what Bad Blood was going to be initially. As soon as I heard like support group with survivors of other horror movie franchises, I was like, well, I'm not as clever as I think I am. You know, because I thought that was a fairly unique idea, but whoops. And I was like,
it's
but
a
you know
great
what?
Idea. It's a great idea.
I was like, that's okay though. I was like, that's okay. Because sadly, unfortunately, because I think this movie would have been really cool. I was like, unfortunately, you know, it wasn't made, but fortunately for me, that idea still hasn't been put out there into the universe. And then the second punch in this 1-2 puncheroo was Grady Hendrix's book Funnel Girls support group or something like that comes out, and now it's going to be a TV show, and I'm just like, well, fuck.
I know, that sucks. Well, at least you know that you have as creative a brain as Grady. That's great.
I kid you not, there have been so many times, not that I've ever even come close to having like even representation or whatever, but I've written so many things where I'm convinced that like the idea is unique and solid. And then like 2 months later, something happens. I remember a buddy of mine who actually works in the industry. He's the guy who's like my first reader who checks out everything. And he's just, I know he feels bad for me because he'll just get back to me and he's like, well, at least you know you're hitting on something. At least you know you have your finger on a pulse. You're not getting there quickly enough, but...
Nobody's coming up with it. It's like the biggest cliche, but it's so true, is there are no original ideas. You just got to do it in your own unique, cute way.
Yeah.
Although, yeah, with that HBO, I think, Max show coming up with Charlize Theron, you might want to act fast because it's happening.
Yeah, you know,
it is such a good idea, though.
It's funny, though, because that very same friend of mine, I would also read his stuff back in the day before he sort of made it into the industry. And he had written something that was very similar. He had started it, and then a big sci-fi movie from a major director came out, and it was sort of trading in the same themes. And there was even a similar, like, sort of set piece in it. And I remember he was kind of like, damn it, you know, he's like, I got to put this to bed. And I was just like, I remember trying to talk him out of it, but I think he was kind of convinced. And then later he was just like, you know what? They don't own that. You know, I can do my riff on that. And sure enough, that was the project that sort of like got him in. So
you never know. Also, like, there's going to be two Hellraiser projects in the same year from completely different production houses. Why not both?
I hear you. I'm okay with that. I'm still wanting to tell that story at some point, but I feel like at this point I probably need to let it breathe for a little bit.
Yeah, maybe like give it 5 years. If I recall, we have Christy, my apologies, from the original Hellraiser in this Hellraiser or Halloween in Hell moment. She dies right at the beginning. Is this correct?
It's so crazy to me because the support group was filled with survivors, obviously, of other horror movie franchises. And it's said that within the group, there's like a character from Phantasm here, a victim from Critters there. The Prophecy and Leprechaun were mentioned as well. Like, imagine this group, you know?
What a weird group, but I love it.
Yeah, and like obviously the two leads are Kirstie Cotton from Hellraiser, and then we have Jamie Lloyd from Halloween. And
it's kind of not an A-list cast across the board, which I celebrate.
Yeah, but it's all the people, you know, with those two together. Like I would watch a movie with Jamie Lloyd and Kirstie Cotton just going for coffee and chatting about their problems.
They're both incredible characters, to be honest. I really love both of them. No, if I'm wrong, say it. Let me have it.
I you know what? I my love for both may cloud my opinion on this. I'll be diplomatic.
He's partisan.
But no, so apparently in the support group meeting, Jamie, you know, she discusses with them, like, Michael Myers, the curse of Thorn, the fact that she can't have a normal life, like, which is a really smart way of sort of cluing in uninitiated viewers who maybe, you know, haven't seen all of the previous Halloween movies. You know, we get caught up to speed pretty quickly on who this woman is. And the meeting ends. The survivors head out into the parking lot and Michael Myers attacks Kirstie Cotton, which I love this idea that Kirstie Cotton from Hellraiser steps in to save Jamie Lloyd from Halloween. But Michael, as you mentioned, kills her. He stabs at her, but she has the LaMarchand puzzle box, the lament configuration in her hands. Mm-hmm. But the force of Michael's sort of stabbing, it shoves the box into her chest and she dies. And I got to tell you, part of me would have been very, very upset that Kirstie sort of dies unceremoniously in this movie. And yet another part of me cannot help but appreciate the fact that Stahlberg and Florsheim were sort of unwittingly or not playing into a trope in the Halloween franchise, which is in the first act, you tend to have heroine, you know, unceremoniously offed. So yeah, he was, you know, they were just riding into that. And yeah, from there, Jamie escapes. She is hit by an ambulance. She's taken away to the hospital as Pinhead arrives to look over the fallen Kirstie. I said Kirstie. That's horrible.
We're
going to
make this mistake. Sorry, everybody. Yeah.
You know what? It's not even, I know better. I know it's Kirstie Cotton, but there's something about it. I look at the word and I'm just like, Kirstie, you know?
I can't say Kirstie. Kirstie's impossible. And then put the word cotton at the end of it. How dare you,
Clive? Kirstie Cotton.
Kirstie Cotton. It's actually the best character name of all time, also the worst character name of all time.
How does Ashley Lawrence not have a line of horror movie t-shirts called like Kirstie's Cotton? You know?
I love it. Or like fancy underwear, you know, like Fruit of the Loom.
Yeah. Just I love, damn it.
We have ideas.
But Kirstie, as Pinhead arrives to look over her, her dying words to him are her dying words are, "You never got me." And Pinhead is furious. Her soul was his, so he's determined to take one, you know, another soul in her stead.
How come he can't just take her, in your opinion, though? Like, she had to have fucked with the box for him to be able to grab her?
I think so. Going from the previous movies, I think he always played fair with her.
He did, actually. I'm always like, he kind of saves the cat with her a couple of times.
Yeah, that is the one thing about Pinhead is, so far as the rules go, like he's fair. He doesn't cheat, you know? And no,
which is almost the scarier part, because if you're fucked, you are out of here, baby. Like,
well, yeah, that's the thing. You know, he is a rule book beater no matter what, which is always terrifying in any regard. But he, you know that there is no... in a way, there is no sort of reasoning with him, except that's exactly what Kirstie does in Hellraiser. She strikes a bargain with him. But I guess the idea is that Pinhead, and, you know, we can kind of go from that moment at the end of part two. There's that respect between them, and there's that weird sort of, there has to be slash fiction out there. There has to be like fanfic with the two of them in it. But no, I think Pinhead just kind of wanted her. And as a result, you know, the way she dies heroically and she dies not opening the box. And so I think he's kind of forever lost her. And as a result, I think he's just kind of pissed. And let's be honest here, I think he's kind of petty. He's kind of petty about it.
Yeah, he's petty. He's petty.
He's like, you know what? Shape, you know, Michael Myers, you're going to take mine. I'm going to take one of yours. So
rude.
Meanwhile, Pinhead and Michael are kind of on a collision course with Jamie Lloyd stuck between them. Michael wants to kill her because of the Thorn Curse. Pinhead wants to take Michael's prey from him by taking her instead. Jamie, by the end of the movie, actually winds up getting pulled into hell and to get to her. And I will admit, there is something corny about this, but there's also something incredibly cool about this. To get to her, Michael unlocks the lament configuration so he can go to hell to get to her. And apparently Michael's weirdly childlike demeanor, as it were, there's something about it that allows him to easily tap into the LaMarchand configuration and to solve it. So he goes to hell, and Jamie and Michael are both tortured by the Cenobites until Michael pulls free and begins slaughtering them. And I love it. Michael and Pinhead go at it. Michael uses Pinhead's chains against him, pulling pins out of his head.
Yeah.
Some pins out of his head. He drives some of them further in. Poor Pinhead would have looked like hell by the end of it.
Yeah, yeah.
And as they're doing that, they're just sort of, they obliterate the landscape around them. And Jamie escapes with the help of one of the transfused survivors who we'll get to. And each of them kind of use lament configurations in their own way to escape. And this is kind of what I love. There's meant to be two different reels sent to movie theaters, two different final reels, each with different winners. So depending on which movie, or rather which theater or which Showtime you watched, you were either going to see Michael or you were going to see Pinhead as the victor, the winner. And given whoever it was, that would be the character that would come for Jamie and her friend at the end, just before they're sealed off forever.
Oh, cool. And,
yeah, and then you would end with Jamie and her friend limping into the sunset. And apparently Mustafa Akkad was not super keen on pitches that deviated from his pretty specific ideas as to what Michael Myers should be. He even gave Stolberg a piece of paper that outlined the rules of the Halloween universe, which very much concerned the bloodline of the Strode family. Where did that go by resurrection? And the initial Stolberg Florsheim MVP Halloween in Hell Michael versus Pinhead pitch very much broke a lot of those rules.
Yes, yes. Too campy for Michael. It seems like the Akkads really were trying to keep him somehow based in naturalism, which is such a joke if you start thinking about 4, 5, and 6. But
yeah, yeah. I get it. Maybe they, especially, here's the thing. I think Bad Blood could have worked like gangbusters and would have made complete sense if it had been done after Halloween 6.
Mm-hmm.
As a follow-up to Halloween H2O, which seemed to sort of...
You can't, yes.
It grounded the franchise again, you know? And so that might have been a bit tougher to pull off. So I kind of get that.
Yes. After H2O, it was like a true blue reboot, H2O. It successfully rebooted it and simplified it, and all of that Thorne stuff was out the window. And thank God. Like, you know, we need that HBO miniseries, but other than that, it was time.
Yeah. Yeah. And it's funny, Stolberg noted that he'd originally wanted Jamie Lee Curtis back as Laurie Strode in the lead, so... Their really? Version of MVP and their version of Bad Blood actually would have been Laurie Strode in the main role. But Stolberg and Florsheim were told that Halloween H2O was her last film.
Yes, she was. I feel like she was vocal about that at the time.
Yeah, because
yeah, I know.
Right after she does the opening of Resurrection, which I just hate.
I know.
Hate
it's
it
not
so much.
For you. It's not for Jinx. We have to respect that, everybody. And we do.
I hiss. I cat hiss. At
it's
that
gross. End. It's disrespectful, to say the least. Yes. I know.
But yeah, no. So with Laurie out of the picture, but Akkad still wanting to stick to the Myers-Strode bloodline, Jamie was brought back into consideration, which I thought was really interesting. And it would have been... I would have been curious to see, like, if they had written a screenplay, you know, really fleshed it all out, how they would have accounted for Halloween H2O. It's like, okay, if you're bringing up the idea of the bloodline again and the curse again, then why is Michael going after Jamie again instead of also trying to go after Laurie? You know,
to have some weird montage at the beginning that's like, Laurie's dead, Jamie, just like they did with part 4.
Oh, that would have pissed me off too. So
yeah, it was honestly, weird in part 4, to be honest.
Halloween H2O has the best ending that original run ever needed.
Yes,
so.
And I don't know if it was you or if it's my friend Emily who says, and I think it may be Emily, that the reason that the beginning of Resurrection is so repulsive is not because they disrespect Laurie Strode, but because they disrespect the ending of H2O. Was that you or was that Emily?
I believe that was Emily, but I agree with her wholeheartedly.
It's true. It's true. It's a real slap in the face.
I hate it.
It's also funny, though. That, like, first he crushes the larynx, then he puts the mask on. It's very organized. He's
which is
a self-starter.
Such
you know?
Bullshit, because when you watch the end of H2O, the look in his eyes, his very well-lit eyes,
he is evil.
The whole point of it is that Laurie has a moment where she wants to connect with her brother, and he reaches out to her, and she reaches out to him. And then she looks up and she sees in his eyes that he's still evil, that he's still devious, that he is counting on her to touch him so that he can do something to try and get himself out of that situation, or at least kill her.
Yeah.
It is not like an EMT with a crushed larynx reaching out to her in that scene.
No. I mean, you know what? Yes, it was. According to canon, it was. We have to respect canon.
The movie's not canon.
Busta Rhymes killed Michael Myers. This is the canon that we live in right now.
I refuse it.
I still want to see Halloween Retribution where we see the death of Freddy, because it seems cool to me. It's weird to me how this Hellraiser crossover kind of turned into Bad Blood. I wasn't aware until I was reading your article, your Phantom Limbs piece about it. And it's cool because you're going from one like super outrageous, very campy project into what feels like a more traditional modern Halloween, which is Halloween Bad Blood.
Yeah, I think so. I mean, Bad Blood, it sounds like, still would have been a little heightened, a little fun, a little funny, you know, a bit campy here and
meta,
there.
Meta, right? It seems very meta.
Totally, by the end of it, it would have been meta as hell.
Which is not a COD approved. Don't be meta with a COD. He doesn't want that.
Yeah, but I looked at Resurrection again, and I remember Busta Rhymes in a Michael Myers mask and costume cursing out mad. The actual Michael. I feel like
Mustafa hated Resurrection. This is the energy I got.
I feel like Mustafa was right too.
You know that I, at least for the next month or so, I'm pro Resurrection. There's nothing you can do to change that. And we have to celebrate each other for who we are, Jake.
Okay, that's only fair. But yeah, you're right. Like, Halloween Bad Blood took the core idea of the survivors group and the transfused blood and the curse of Thorn, and it just sort of, you know, it removed all the Hellraiser references and
which
then built
good.
A new movie around it. And
it's so much better without Hellraiser in it. I have to say, I'm a big Hellraiser fan, but it just muckied up this plot.
Agreed. And this is, I mean, that Halloween Hellraiser movie is a movie that I 100% would have watched. I don't know that I would have dug it. I got to tell you, Halloween Bad Blood, I get the feeling that I would have dug the hell out of this movie. I really do.
Wait, so why do you think, after the huge success of Freddy vs. Jason, that we never did see another Versus in the franchise world? Do you think it's because they didn't want to be compared to it? Or what do you think the cause was there?
I think it was just the lack of franchise characters to go around, because, you know, it feels like there are so many, but when, you know, you look at who owns who and then the compatibility. I mean, yeah, Freddy versus Jason, which that makes all the sense in the world.
Yeah.
So Dimension looked at their properties and they were like, Halloween Hellraiser, how about that? And
closest you get to like being a maybe. Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, definitely I would agree with that. And at the same time, like, you know, I completely understand why Malik Akkad was like, I recently interviewed him and he talked about that. It hasn't gone up yet, but he mentioned, he was like, I was always a hard no on that. He was like, just absolutely not. And I get it. You know, they want to protect their character. They want to protect their brand.
They're the only people in this industry that seem to have a little bit of, I don't know, what's the word? Not class, but they take it seriously. And it's not just a money grab for them. It is a money grab for them, but they respect their franchise.
I don't know that it is. That's the thing.
Yeah, not at all.
Somebody said, you know, and again, having interviewed him, like he, obviously, you know, with his father having passed, you get the sense that he respects the legacy of the character and the franchise and that he's trying to do his best. And he even admits, you know, when I did the interview with him, he was like, look, we're always trying to stay true to the character and stay true to the franchise. And he was like, we don't always get it right. And he was like, but we're always trying.
They are. And you can tell that they are. And every once in a while, they really do get it right. I've always thought it would be really amazing to do like a documentary on the Akkads, because there's so much interesting stuff that goes down.
100%.
And the way that like their own family line kind of mirrors the whole like family bloodline part within Halloween. It's like this family didn't have that many film franchises that were recognizable or film projects that were recognizable, but Halloween was sort of their big property, and it's such a family themed property. I don't know. I feel like you could get some poetic back and forth in a doc.
I think that's a great approach for a Halloween documentary that would show us something that we haven't seen that often. And plus, it's funny, I just found a documentary on YouTube. Somebody had cut together, I think, Daniel Farren's home videos from the set, and they, you know, cut it together, put some narration. It's actually quite good, but there was just a lot of footage of Mustafa Akkad on set, and he seemed like the coolest guy. Like, he seemed like just this warm, grandfatherly type, you
know? He sounds cool. He sounds a little scary, you take what he says very seriously. Like, you don't want to disappoint him, and I feel like it's possible to disappoint him.
Well, it was nice to hear that unlike Phil Rosenberg's script for Halloween 6, you know, he did not throw Halloween bad blood across the room after he read it. That we know. So I would like to think he didn't.
I feel like, I don't know, the bar was kind of on the floor. Kind of.
But yeah. Well, I mean, if we eventually got to it, I'm not going to do it. I'm not going to knock Resurrection again. I'm going to move on.
I respect you.
Be diplomatic, Jinx. Just rein it in. So, no, but I honestly, yes. So I think Bad Blood, one, I think that title would have changed. I get the feeling, even though it is, I mean, it does totally refer to what's happening in the story in a really fun and clever way.
Such a good title.
It is. I just can't see it as being like, there was something almost like hammery about the subtitles that the franchise had up until that point. You know, you had the Return of Michael Myers, The Revenge of Michael Myers, The Curse of Michael Myers, H2O.
Totally.
You know, it's like, oh, what?
Yeah, it's clearly something has changed. And Bad Blood has that really, like, modern feel.
Yeah, I get that. I would have preferred them, you know, keeping on with the more luxurious subtitles. Just, you know, The Blood of Michael Myers, you know, something like that.
I like that.
Yeah, much like MVP, Bad Blood opened in Chicago. It began with a support group, very much like the one from MVP, except it wasn't all Final Girls or survivors from previous horror franchises. It was just a group of folks. And Jamie Lloyd was really the only Final Girl of the group in this version, which, again, I think goes towards sort of grounding this version of the story as opposed to the more heightened one that we got before. You know, we don't have Leprechaun and Prophecy survivors and Critters survivors here. So, this one, Bad Blood, was the one that was written around November of 2000, so it was before Resurrection, but it was far beyond the point of Halloween H2O, which, Halloween H2O retconned Jamie out of existence, and also Part 6, where she was killed in both cuts. So,
which makes me think, why did they even think to bring her back? It doesn't seem like something that ever would have flown.
I don't know. I do love the idea that Stolberg and Florsheim had figured out how to account for the death in 6. They kind of did it in two ways. You know, early on, we find out that Jamie is, you know, pretty badly scarred up. And, you know, so obviously there have been many battles that she and Michael has had that we haven't been privy to. And presumably she was meant to have just survived Part 6, except, you know, that would fly on its own, I think. And maybe I'm getting ahead of myself. I'm sorry. But there is an explanation as to why we saw Jamie Lloyd killed in Halloween 6, and yet she's running around here, and it involves
I don't think I know.
Oh, okay. I'll surprise you with it later on because it's pretty great. Because it is neat. It's a cool idea later on that's kind of revealed, because the entire time, you know, horror fans would have been like, now wait a second, you know, I saw her destroyed with a farm implement.
And this was before we were used to retconning. Like, it was not a thing yet.
The uninitiated viewers back then would have been like, what the hell? Much like in the previous movie, or rather the previous treatment, MVP, in the support group, Jamie notes how long it's been since Michael tried to kill her. And it's something like, she has it down to the hour, you know, like 7 months, so many days, so many hours. And she describes the Thorn Curse, Michael Myers. She points out that she hasn't been able to have a life. She can't have a relationship because Michael keeps hunting her down and killing anybody around her, you know, until she can escape him again. And it's at this point in the story that there's an abusive husband of one of the support group members. He pops up with a knife going after one of the members, presumably his wife. And Jamie sort of, you know, she takes matters into her own hands and disarms him, which shows that all of her constant fighting throughout the years has honed her into a pretty effective ass kicker, as
it were. Yeah, totally. It kind of gave me a little bit of Your Next energy.
Yeah, oh, totally, totally. Which would have been so cool to see Danielle Harris in that kind of role, which we do eventually see her kind of in that role anyway with Mary Beth in the two Hatchet sequels.
Yes, and she kind of looks like, what's the lead from Your Next? Do you know her name offhand?
Sharni Vinson.
Do they look alike to you, or is it just me?
I could see it. I could see the...
You know what else Danielle Harris kind of looks like to me is the lead from Sorority Row and the Town That Dreaded Sundown remake. I think it's the same person. Do you know who I'm talking about?
So I think it's Brianna Evigan in Sorority Row, and I think it's...
Oh my God, it's two different people?
It is two different people.
Oh, no.
The Town That Dreaded Sundown was... she's a very good actor.
She was so good.
And I forget her name. That's awful. I'm so sorry.
Okay, well, at least you knew it was two different people. It's very important because I could have been in a lot of trouble. So
I am. I'm going to look her up as.
It's brunettes with bangs. It's like it's hard to know. It's hard to tell them apart.
And talking about a great movie, The Town That Dreaded Sundown remake is better than it had any right to be.
I just watched it this weekend, and I loved it. Except for if it wasn't for the ending, which I'm not a fan of, I think it would have been kind of a classic.
You're right. It's funny, though. That is, you know, the original Town That Dreaded Sundown, and equally kind of ends with that that sort of maddening tease. You know, it's like, well, what's going on here? What's the deal? What's happening?
I feel like it wasn't rewarding enough, and it didn't make any sense. But I just loved it. And I love the whole mythos that it depends on from real life, but also expands upon. Very Ryan Murphy.
No, totally. Which I really love some of his forays into horror. I really do. I know it seems to be hip as hell to knock him sometimes because not every season of American Horror Story is sterling. But I'm like, you know what? That guy is doing some really interesting stuff in the genre.
How many days is he on that set in actuality?
Nowadays? Yeah. He's got to be doing something right because the damn thing's run for a decade and has a spinoff. So. Respect.
Yep, and the spinoff got another season. Did you watch American Horror Stories?
I saw the first two seasons and I actually loved them quite a bit. I started the third and for whatever reason never got around to finishing it.
Oh,
and
I meant the off brand. Sorry, the spinoff. The
No. I felt like I needed to because I heard that Ben Harmon was back in it from the first season, but he'd also appeared in a later season. So I'm like, well, I guess I'm gonna have to finally catch up on the OG series before I watch the spinoff. So
I feel like I've interrupted you. We were in the midst of like some really juicy stuff. Where were you?
Oh, sorry. I did find out her name though. The Town That Dreaded Sundown starred Addison Timlin, who was very good in that movie.
So good.
So Michael pops up at the support group, begins cutting his way through the support group.
You knew. Jamie. You knew. Okay. Amazing.
In the midst of all of this, Jamie and Michael are hit by an ambulance and both are taken to the hospital where the doctors sort of marvel at all the scars that Jamie's body bears. And there's a quote, "The doctors can't believe the number of scars and stab wounds on Jamie's body. This pretty girl looks like a one-woman war zone." And I just love that idea. It reminds me of, the first time, I think it was the first superhero movie to kind of do something like this, but the reveal of Affleck's body in the shower in Daredevil, where it's like, okay, this is a superhero movie, but this is also a guy who, you know, we're going to take a realistic look at what fights would be like.
It's so badass, especially with the case of Jamie. It's like, it's very military.
Yeah,
cool.
And I love the idea that it's like, how many adventures, how many Halloween sequels have we missed between these two? You know, I love that idea.
And I love how it's clear that he is relentlessly coming after her, but she's also relentlessly surviving. It's cool.
Yeah. She's not just a final girl one time over. It seems like the story is introducing the notion that, you know, she's a survivor time and time and time and time again. But it's here that the main plot kicks into gear. And I love this. Jamie has her own personal blood supply at the hospital, presumably in preparation for events like this when she gets attacked and needs treatment, which is crazy to think that she's been attacked so many times that she's had to prep for it by giving the nearest local hospital blood to keep on standby for the inevitable. I love that idea.
What do the authorities think of this, though? There's this hole is here, but I'm okay.
Yeah, well, yeah, it's like, how did she pull that off? Did she go to the hospital and just pay somebody off to keep, like, a supply out of the way?
It's very Buffy the Vampire Slayer, so I can get behind that.
Oh, I love it. And I love that. I mean, that makes all the sense in the world that you would have a final girl who just keeps her own blood supply around because she's going to need it. But what mm-hmm. I love about this idea is that in all of the chaos, a nurse makes a mistake and puts Jamie's personal supply into the main storage freezer, where it is then used to help 7 random people who get transfused with Jamie's personal blood supply, which comes with the Thorn Curse.
Fuck yes. Fuck yes. It's so stupid, but it's so good. Love it.
Hence the title Bad Blood.
Yeah, baby.
That is such a neat idea that all of a sudden you have all of these. And plus, there is a moment in their treatment where Michael, he gets his knife, I think, or some sort of killing implement. He's advancing on Jamie, who is actually helpless in the hospital bed at this point. I think she's strapped down because she was struggling, and he has her. He has her dead to rights. And then you have this moment where you're seeing all these different people transfused at once with Jamie's blood. And apparently there was meant to be like a CG sequence where you see the blood flowing down the IV line and into their bodies, signaling that, you know, these people now have the curse. And Michael...
Oh, it's like the Jason X opening sequence.
Kind of, yeah, yeah. And Michael has this moment where he stops and is just kind of confused because he can feel that the curse has now shot out to 7 other people. And so he staggers away trying to find like all of these other people at once. And
it sucks. It sucks for him. It's like you thought you were so close to the end and then all of a sudden the goals change.
You know, if he could speak, tell me that wouldn't be a moment for him to just be like, fuck.
That's exactly what I was going to say. Yeah. It's pretty funny actually if you think about it on that level, because he was so close. 6-7 movies, 8 movies, then this bullshit has to happen.
Better yet, you know what? If you wanted to stay completely true to the character, just do the fuck thing, but just silently, where you see him standing there and you just see him wilt a little bit, his shoulders slump, and you just hear like...
yeah, but then he would like prop back up and keep going, because this is a self-starter, as we said.
Absolutely. So... Michael is no longer compelled to just go after Jamie. He now has over a half dozen new victims that he has to slaughter. And these include, do you want to call off the victims to beat, or do you want me to?
Sure, I can run through this list of character names. So we've got Amber Lynn, who is a fake attempted suicide. We have Betsy, which is a 10-year-old tomboy with cancer. We've got Ed, which is a goth vampire wannabe who sneaks into the hospital and drinks Jamie's blood supply. Gross. We have Leon, a badass stuntman who winds up in the hospital after an onset injury. Uh-oh. We have Sheila, a plastic surgery addict, socialite. We have Berger, hemophiliac. Gus, a 24-year-old student who suffers from severe OCD. And then last but not least, my favorite character, we have Horace Merriweather, an eccentric serial killer enthusiast whose gothic house is home to an extensive collection of items related to Michael Myers' exploits.
Love it. Yeah. And I don't believe, he doesn't get transfused, I don't believe, but he is definitely like one of the major supporting characters in the story.
Who would you cast as Horace?
You know, they said, Stahlberg said like, well, actually I think it was in the treatment, think Steve Buscemi, and...
All right.
You know, I can't top that, so...
No, that's good. You know, if it was today, it would be like some 30-year-old that's like hot, but like with glasses on.
It would either, you're 100% right, it would either be that or it would be like something fan servicey. Like, you would get Robert Englund in the role, you know, or.
If this was 1998, absolutely.
which I would be okay with. I think that would actually be pretty cool.
I mean, Wishmaster is my favorite movie, so me too.
Yeah, Wishmaster is so good. Did you just see Peter Atkins, the guy who wrote Wishmaster? He is publishing his original screenplay for Hellraiser Bloodline.
No.
Which is...
Oh, yes, so, I did see this.
So, yes, we get to read his original screenplay now, which differs wildly from the butchered theatrical version of the film that we eventually got. So I'm
which I like, but yeah, it's very butcherino. You know how like there's like 5 subtitles that is interchangeable in all horror movies? I feel like Bloodline actually would have worked pretty neatly for this one.
Yeah, Halloween Bloodline. Yeah, no, that would have, it would have fit.
Like a cute direct-to-video sequel that like had its moments.
Yeah, you know, that's totally what this movie seems like it would have been. And that's not a knock against Stolberger or Florsheim. It's no knock on the story, which I think
could
have been theatrical. But this seems like this was the kind of era where Dimension was starting to transition all of their major franchises to direct-to-DVD or direct-to-video, you know?
Yeah, so huge time. It was when direct-to-DVD was a huge, or just even becoming a huge market. And as you know even better than I do, they were really starting to investigate direct-to-video items for the Halloween franchise, including Two Faces of Evil, which actually sounds pretty good and did turn into H2O, if I'm not mistaken.
Yeah, yeah, I think that would have been cool. Yeah, and I think we probably have the cons to thank for keeping the franchise theatrical. I think they were probably, you know, that was probably one of the many issues
yes.
that the Akkads and Dimension had when they were wrestling with ownership over that that franchise. But I'm glad the Akkads.
Well, they were right, because it destroyed Hellraiser for so long. Because we got like 20 years of unwatchable Hellraiser movies.
Well,
okay, fine. Hellworld was incredible, actually.
No.
I talk about it every other episode. I probably said it to you. I like Hellworld. It's so funny.
I will give Hellworld this, and please, I want it on the record that this is the only thing that I'm giving Hellworld, is that it is a beautifully made, very well cast movie for what it is. Like you can tell they put, that's the thing about those early 2000s, like Dimension movies.
$7 million, right? Like they put in
something
money.
Stupid. Like, yeah, you would now those movies would get like a $500,000 budget.
Yes.
Back in the day, they pumped millions into them. They shot them on film, and they, like I gotta say, Hellraiser Inferno from Scott Derrickson, I dig
not
it.
Not bad, not bad.
Hellseeker, which is essentially the
that
same
Scott Derrickson. Oh wow, funny how things turn out in the end.
Yeah, Inferno was. This was a couple of years before he did The Exorcism of Emily Rose and probably about a decade before Sinister. But and then we had Hellseeker, which brought Ashley Lawrence back, which
yes,
I think
did.
Is a lot of fun. We have Debtor, which is, I think, fun. I think Debtor's okay.
I've always just been very confused by the title as someone that hasn't actually seen it.
Oh, so it revolves around a cult, basically.
It always does.
Yeah, and then we have Hellworld, and then we have we have Hellraiser Revelations. Which,
I know, very sad. It's truly a very dark, upsetting moment in horror history. And then there's Judgment,
which I think is pretty cool.
I like the history. I like the background story. It's inspiring.
Yeah, like the Gary Tunnicliffe, you know, the
yes.
guy who had done the makeup on loads of Dimension things, I'm sure, like Halloween. And as a matter of fact, he, I believe, if I'm getting this right, Gary Tunnicliffe actually crafted a version of the Shape mask that was going to harken back to the original Shatner mask for Tyler Mane to wear over mm-hmm. top of his burned face in Halloween 3D, the Todd Farmer, Patrick Lussier movie. So I love Gary Tunnicliffe. I got to interview him once and he was super cool. But
Icon.
Yes. And he did some, you know, they finally gave him his turn at bat before they completely went under. And I think Tunnicliffe did something really interesting with, I mean, I think they gave him $17 for a budget and he turned out a movie that was super imaginative. You know, the Stygian Inquisition I thought was a great idea. It had a great kind of grimy look to it. You know, some of the cop stuff didn't work, but I think he showed incredible promise as a storyteller, and I wish he had been given another turn at bat.
Yeah, you know, with some real support behind him would be nice.
Give him a $500,000 budget. I think he would have murdered.
Did he not even get that? Was it like $250,000 or something?
I'm sure it was something not great.
It's just let the franchise go. Please, if you're going to do that, it's just so rude.
Well, that's what bums me out is now Hellraiser's been discovered and it's been parsed out where we have
you know,
David Gordon Green doing the HBO series. And we have, which I'm excited about, we have Ben Collins and Luke Piotrowski having written a Hellraiser movie directed by David Bruckner. So we have the creative team behind The Night House, which was fucking incredible, doing a Hellraiser movie. There was that super exciting casting for Pinhead.
Yep, Jamie Clayton.
Yes, everything is going right for that movie. David Gordon Green doing Hellraiser, I'm not so sure about, but I'm willing to wait.
Is it going to happen? Is it going to happen? That's what I keep asking. I'm not convinced.
What bums me out about all of it, and I don't want to, as somebody has pointed out about other things online, and I think they're right, I don't want to second guess any creative team's decisions, and I'm willing to see them out and check anything out. But what bums me out is, we got the movie and we have the HBO series, and I haven't heard Gary Tunnicliffe's name anywhere. No, and this is a man who worked on that franchise for nearly 30 years.
Yeah.
So it's like, wait, come on, just bring him back. Damn it.
It's horrendous when that happens. Like with Mancini in the reboot at Orion.
Yeah.
That was gross. Yeah. But at least we have these projects seem fairly prestige, and it's not how we've seen Hellraiser in so long. So I'm ready for it.
Absolutely. So Bad Blood, I think, would have been worthy of theatrical, but at that point in Dimension's history, you got to know they were probably, if they would have ever picked this up, they probably would have pushed hard for direct-to-video. I really wish this movie existed. I wish that somehow, some way, it had gotten made at some point, because I think it would have been a lot of fun. Because, my goodness, we have Michael, who's now pissed off, trying to track down a group of characters who are now cursed with, Thorn.
Yeah.
Just by virtue of the fact that they were transfused. And honestly, like, going through the body count, like, a lot of these sound, not just the set pieces, but the characters themselves at times sound really fun in the way that they were set up. Like, okay, so first up is Amber, who Michael chases out of the hospital. Like, she is essentially victim number one. He goes after her, and there's a twist on the scene in the original Halloween with, near the end where Laurie is running from house to house and she's screaming for help. And, the lights turn on and then they turn off, and you can tell that people are ignoring her because they don't think that she's actually in trouble.
Amazing.
There is a twist on that sequence where this Amber character is running around. She eventually, Michael's almost on her, and she's like, to hell with it. I think she grabs a brick and she breaks into somebody's home. Michael comes after her, and Amber gets killed, not by Michael, but by the shotgun-toting homeowner who thinks that she is an intruder.
Genius.
So she gets killed by the homeowner, and then Michael kills the homeowner right after, which I think is, it's kind of genius. It's kind of fun.
It's anti-gun violence.
Then we have blood-drinking Ed, who sees Michael, tries to befriend him, thinking that he had met him at a Rob Zombie concert or something. He tries to convince him to join in a vampire bloodletting ritual. Michael does join in a bloodletting ritual, but not necessarily the one that Ed expected. So there goes Ed.
Oh, well.
he overdosed. This is crazy. So Sheila gets an overdose of Botox thanks to Michael, which paralyzes her. And then at that point, he descends upon her. Like, he, Michael does his thing. He eventually beheads her. The Gus character has OCD, which, and this I think is, it's fun in its own way. Like, it makes him, his OCD makes it nearly impossible for him to escape from Michael. There's a sequence where he's trying to escape and he has to stop and mind the cracks on a tiled porch.
Oh, that's stressful.
Yeah, I like that. You feel bad. I got the feeling it's not necessarily, it wasn't making fun of him, but it was pointing out, like, what would a person who has to contend with that sort of thing be like in a situation where they're being chased by a maniac? And there is this amazing moment where I think he runs past a discarded penny and stops and sees Michael coming right at him, and he has to take a breath and race right back toward Michael.
Oh, it's tragic.
Stop and pick up the penny and narrowly escape Michael's knife. But he does make it for the moment. You have the stuntman character, Leon, and I do love this. This is a moment that kind of, like, it reminds me of the opening of Feast, where you have this alpha male dude who is going to, he kind of alpha males his way in. He's going to lead the group. And 8.5 seconds later, the treatment says he gets cut up by Michael. So literally he has his big Sam Jackson giving a speech in Deep Blue Sea moment.
Yeah.
And then Michael kills his ass, which I love.
God, I love Feast, by the way.
Feast is great.
So good.
I like that movie quite a lot. I'm still waiting for Project Greenlight Season 3 to hit DVD. Where is it? It's been 18 years.
Are there even DVDs anymore?
There were, fair point. There were, you know, it bugs me. It makes me twitch because there were DVD compilations of Project Greenlight Seasons 1 and 2. So, you know, could they not give us one for the horror season? Damn it, you know?
Where's Vinegar Syndrome at?
Yeah, that's
pick it up.
You joke, but maybe, you know,
yeah. I
could throw that out to him. There is Betsy, who you pointed out in the earlier version. She is a 10-year-old cancer survivor. She's kind of a tomboy. And I love it. Again, you know, you have the idea of a character with OCD trying to escape a slasher. In Betsy, you have a cancer survivor who isn't afraid of dying. So I love the idea that Solberg and Florsheim are taking these characters and they're sort of tweaking the archetypes and the tropes to be like, well, what would it be like? Let's look at different people and how they would react in a situation with a slasher. You know, what would a badass alpha male who's proud of himself look like? He's probably the guy who would be cocky and get his ass killed straight away. The OCD guy, you know, would have trouble escaping by virtue of like trying to contend with OCD. You know, we have a cancer survivor who, you know, doesn't give a shit about dying. So how is she going to react in that situation? Then on top of all that, there's the character Berger, who is a hemophiliac who could die from a paper cut. Now having to run away from a masked slasher. Like, that's a great idea.
It's so clever. All of these are just so good.
So we have, so you mentioned Horace Merriweather. Let's go ahead and think Steve Buscemi or 90s Robert Englund, I don't know, who he and Jamie know one another. And Jamie sort of believes that Merriweather's home is kind of her safe haven. And from the treatment, quote, "We also find out that Horace and Jamie share a symbiotic relationship. He has paid Jamie for Meyer's artifacts in the past, allowing her to live on the lam. We even find out Horace was the one who helped Jamie." And this is the major thing, which I love. I don't know that I would buy it, but I love the big swing. "We even find out Horace was the one who helped Jamie change her identity and find a decoy, although it resulted in the death of her doppelganger, actress J.C. Brandy."
Yeah.
Unquote. "In a conversation between Jamie, Horace, and Betsy, the trio realize the connection Jamie has to all of the blood transfusion recipients and therefore understand why Michael is now targeting numerous potential victims." So we have Jamie, we have Betsy. At this point, Gus and Berger headed along to Merriweather's as well, and they get killed. So we're down to Merriweather, Jamie, and Betsy. And unfortunately, Horace bites it. So, you know, that's very sad that Merriweather, you know, I would just feel sad if Steve Buscemi got stabbed to death by Michael Myers. I don't know why.
Me too.
It makes me sad to think of.
It's how Ghost World ended.
You know, I flashed The Sopranos, the end of what, season 4, when Tony kills Steve Buscemi on his porch. It's like, yeah, did you have to do that?
Spoilers, God.
Okay, it's 18 years old. So Merriweather is dead. The climax finds Jamie and Michael alone in the now deceased Merriweather's collection room, quote, "where he stores every weapon from the Halloween movies," unquote.
Meta as fuck. Is this the first time it gets super meta? No, because he's obsessed with Michael Myers.
Yeah, we had already started tiptoeing toward there, but then now with the climax, Jamie and Michael Myers are doing battle. They're wielding every weapon they can get their hands on. Quote, "it turns into an all-out slasher fest between a badass Jamie and Michael as they go toe-to-toe. This is what we've been waiting to see. Jamie is obviously well-trained, her whole life spent preparing for this moment," unquote. Mm-hmm. The story at this point also brings back the connection, the telepathic connection between Jamie and Michael that we saw in Halloween 5, which allows the two of them to have kind of a sense of what their opponent is going to do. So not only are these two well-trained killers in their own right, but they can kind of anticipate what the other is going to do before it happens. So I think the idea of having that, like the attack and counterattack, just be kind of wild, you know, between the two of them, I think that's so much fun. And, but weirdly enough, Jamie is saved by Betsy, ultimately, who uses the heavy farm machinery that dispatched Jamie's double in Halloween 6 to subdue Michael before Jamie ultimately finishes him with the first butcher's knife that Michael ever used.
Cute.
It's so much. I mean, it's just fun, you know? It's
very fun.
The treatment concludes, quote, "The original butcher's knife that started it all will be the instrument that will dispatch Michael to his death. And Jamie and Betsy limp into the sunset," unquote. End of treatment. End of Halloween Bad Blood.
Oh, it's so clever. And I can see how they were almost trying to pander a little bit to the Akkads, but they did it wrong.
Well, yeah. You know, Mustafa Akkad said that he was all about following the Strode-Myers bloodline story. Tell me they didn't do that. Like, they...
Oh, they did it. They did it. And they did it brilliantly. It has, like, a Freddy versus Jason energy. Very fun. That's... Very, like, fast-paced.
Here's the thing. I don't think Halloween Bad Blood, and I'm not just talking about like honestly, I think Daniel Harris could still lead a movie, obviously, as this, you know, kind of ass-kicking character, and I wish he would. Mm-hmm. But I just mean, like, I don't think Halloween Bad Blood could exist in 2021, 2022, 2023. I just think that, we're it's not the time yet to be revisiting that. You know, we've gone through the 70s revival in the early aughts. We've gone through the 80s thing, you know, about 5 or 6 years ago. We're currently in the 90s, sort of reliving all of those movies and that level of style, you know, that we had back then.
Was it Rob Zombie movies took place in the 70s? Is that what you just said?
No, oh, no, no, no. I'm sorry. I just meant horror as a whole.
I would have believed you.
But, you know, like... I think Halloween Bad Blood would have lived very comfortably in 2000, 2001, 2002. Like that, it would have been perfectly cut for the time.
Yeah.
And I think audiences would have been very receptive to it. Now, I don't think it would be the right time for this kind of movie, but I would still enjoy the hell out of it.
You know how little bits and pieces from the canceled films kind of make their way down the pipeline? Sort of like how in Halloween Kills you have the Haddonfield versus Michael.
Oh, and totally.
That's been kind of brewing for a really long time in the treatment world. I feel like the twist of having Strode blood accidentally infused into a bunch of strangers, I feel like that plot point could make its way at some point.
I can
not
see
with
that.
Danielle Harris, probably, but like maybe with Jamie or whoever else, I could see it making it because it's just so fun.
I agree. And apparently, at the end of the treatment, there were, and I don't think I wrote about this in Phantom Limbs, but there were two variations on the idea that that Stolberg and Florsheim pitched. One was going to be a Hong Kong set version with Jet Li as a character, and with the heroine in a foreign land, not understanding the language. So
kind of cool.
It would have been like, you know, just the idea of removing, which in a way it kind of makes sense that like, if Jamie wanted to get away from Michael, hop a damn plane, you know,
Hong Kong. Yeah. Go really far away. I wonder if that's a post The Grudge decision.
No, because it would have been 2000. So, I think it would have been pretty neat if they tried to do something like that with the franchise. The other one, though, so there was another idea that they had pitched alongside it. It only existed as a paragraph. It doesn't sound like it was really a variation on Bad Blood. What it reads, it says, "So basically they had an idea to do a film that would have run parallel to the first two Halloween movies, depicting Michael's escape from Smith's Grove, but it would have been like Halloween 1 and 2, but from Michael's point of view. So we would follow him as he escapes from Smith's Grove, as he's stalking around Haddonfield, you know, like his ride to Haddonfield, what was happening with him in the interim of those films. And then when those moments intersect with the movies that we know, we would get like alternate angles on certain scenes. So it would be like a really interesting way to retell those events, but from Michael's point of view, like following him instead. And I kind of love that idea too. I wish they had developed that more, but
wow, sounds like we'd finally figure out how he learned how to drive.
Yeah, exactly. Well, we know because the man in black, oh, Dr. Right. Wynn, clearly.
No, it was him. Dr. Toomis from Halloween 2018. I call him Dr. Toomis.
Oh, God. Sartain.
I hated him. You know how I feel, right? I think everyone knows how I feel. It's my Halloween resurrection. No, it's not. I have to take that out. People get so mad at me.
But yeah, unfortunately, as cool as I personally think Bad Blood might have been and how neat I think it would have been at the time to have that movie. Because come on, we were leading up to Freddy vs. Jason. It was after Bride of Chucky. Halloween Bad Blood would have been seated perfectly between those two, I think.
Perfectly. Give this to Ronnie Yu, please.
Oh, wow. Could you imagine?
Yeah, I can. Actually, I can't.
Ronnie Yu would have directed the hell out of it. Unfortunately, Mustafa Akkad didn't much care for Bad Blood, as it didn't, quote, follow the rules, unquote, either. Plus, Mr. Stolberg admitted in our interview that he was a young writer who just hadn't written much in the way of horror at that point. As he said, and again, I'm quoting, he said, again, it was 20 years ago. It was before I'd ever written a horror movie. I just had no shot. There was no way they were going to hire the writer of Sabrina, the animated series, to reinvent Halloween.
That's their loss, honey.
He wound up writing Alex Aja's Piranha 3D. He wrote Sorority Row, which is a fun slasher. He wrote Jigsaw. So he wrote Spiral. I believe he's still working on Nightbreed, the TV version of it.
Interesting.
There's a potential new Saw sequel. And he eventually worked on another potential Halloween film, as we noted, called Halloween Asylum. Which I think Matt Vane had written a draft of it, and then Stolberg was brought in to sort of do a take on it. And so there is a Josh Stolberg penned Halloween Asylum, which sadly didn't get picked up. And so, I mean, the man has pitched on Halloween 3 times now. At some point in the future, I hope he gets to fully sort of see one through someday. You know, I think he deserves it.
I think so, too. I feel like it may not happen, but we'll have to see.
I have my fingers crossed.
Halloween ends. Yeah, me too. Yeah, I think you're right. I don't think this one is ever going to see the light of day, which is such a shame because I'm such a fan of the plot. It's so fun and so clever, but it definitely has that mid-2000s, early 2000s energy that because the canon got squashed by Busta Rhymes, you're not going to see it. I love that. That was so good, Jinx. This was like a really fun, like really fast-paced episode, which definitely is in line with Halloween by Blood.
Yeah, I think it's a movie that would have just clicked by.
Yeah, it absolutely would have. All right, Jinx. So where can we find you on the internet if you want to be found?
Sure, people can find me. So I host a podcast called Screamatics, which is currently doing a side project called Hammer Pub, where in co-hosts Ali Chapel and Paul Farrell and I have a drink or two, and we provide a running commentary for a Hammer film. I believe, Josh, you are coming on soon for The Woman in Black. Is that right?
Yes. Hell yes.
Good deal. So you can find me there, and Screamatics has its own Twitter account as well. That is at Screamatics. You can also find me, my personal account on Twitter, that is at Jinx1981, that is JINX1981, and you can also find me on Instagram, it is at Jinx740941, I am so sorry, that is JINX740941, it's too many damn numbers, and I apologize, but yes, that's where you can find me. Otherwise, you can check out my work at Bloody Disgusting. I have 4 different columns that I run, and they are Phantom Limbs, Larval Ink, Mask of Insanity, and Blood Ink Staples, regarding respectively unmade horror sequels, early versions of films that changed wildly by the time they were released, fun stories from actors and actresses who wore makeup or masks in horror movies, playing villains, that is, and horror comic books. Josh, it is always a blast. I'm happy to come back anytime.
Yeah, it'll be sooner than later. Absolutely.
All right. Well, thank you so much for listening. And we'll be back with another episode of Development Hell.
Thank you for listening to the Dread Podcast Network.